From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is Talk of the Nation. Democrat Bill Pascrell of New Jersey has joined one of the most elite bodies on earth, the United States Congress, and has a lapel pin that says so.
They gave us two pins, but this year the color is green, but they also gave us a red pin and your card to vote.
Good.
My mother and father would be so proud.
There's a lot to learn these first few weeks, how to get from here to there, how to vote, the committee system, and a job that demands that you plunge right in. The citizens from your state and your 265 million other bosses around the country are waiting for a Congress that works. Are they going to get it? Join four new U.S. senators on Talk of the Nation right after this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A meeting set for tonight in the Mideast could put the finishing touches on a plan to withdraw Israeli troops from the West Bank town of Hebron. A U.S. diplomat says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat will meet. They may conclude the tense negotiations. The Associated Press quotes a senior Israeli official who says the meeting could end with agreement, but not necessarily the signing of a pact. There reportedly are a few more details on the pullout yet to be worked out. The White House today announced a $3.9 billion five-year aid plan for Washington, D.C. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president will include a package of assistance for the district in his budget proposal, including an additional $339 million over 5 years to help pay for prison construction, the court system, transportation, tax collection, Medicaid payments, tax incentives, and pension liabilities. The White House is in effect offering to pick up many of the financial responsibilities that states shoulder for their cities. As part of the president's plan, Congress would no longer have to approve the city's annual budget. Although the White House has been keeping quiet about most of the proposals it plans to announce in its early February budget submission, the president's press secretary, Mike McCurry, said Mr. Clinton wanted to announce the district package before the inauguration because the president wanted the country to know that the city is in distress and what the federal government plans to do about it. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Belgrade, the government of Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic appears to have made major concessions. After nearly 2 months of street protests, the Electoral Commission has reportedly overruled earlier decisions and given opposition parties control of the Belgrade City Council and Serbia's second city of Niš. NPR's Edward Lifson reports from Belgrade.
Control of the two large cities was a major goal of the opposition demonstrations. Both Niš and Belgrade have city-controlled television stations. The opposition says it will need media access to counter the pro-Milosevic state-controlled television network if it is to defeat Milosevic in presidential elections, which are to be held before the end of the year. The opposition leaders downplayed today's developments. Zoran Djindjic of the Democracy Party says President Milosevic is just buying time. Today's concessions can be appealed by the Socialist Party and could still be overturned by the courts. But since the electoral boards are believed to be controlled by Milosevic, today's announcements seem to indicate his willingness to concede. There are still more than a dozen towns across Serbia in which the opposition claims its local victories have yet to be recognized. Protest leaders of the opposition say they'll continue demonstrating in the streets until all of their election victories are reinstated. In Belgrade, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 40 points at 6,749. Trading is very heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, inflation at the consumer level was well contained in December, according to the monthly report from the Labor Department. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The government says the consumer price index rose 0.3% in December, largely due to increases in the price of fuel. But when the volatile food and fuel sectors are excluded, the core rate of inflation was just 0.1%. The core rate is the one economists watch most closely for signs of surging inflation. For all of 1996, the core rate was 2.6%, the same as 1994. To find a lower core rate of inflation, one would have to go back 30 years. Higher food and energy prices caused the overall rate of inflation to rise in 1996 to 3.3%, up from 2.5% the previous year. But investors focus on the core rate. They were happy with the December performance, so stocks rose and long-term interest rates fell. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
Busy signals have sparked a lawsuit against the country's biggest computer online service. Five subscribers to America Online have filed a class action suit on behalf of all California subscribers, asking $20 million in damages. The suit claims AOL's new flat rate pricing plan has clogged the system with more customers than it can handle. An AT&T communications satellite that Loral Space and Communications has agreed to buy has been out of operation since Saturday. Operators aren't sure if they'll regain contract. The incident could be significant for Loral, which was supposed to complete purchase of the satellite by the end of March. Loral expects to go ahead with the acquisition. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. This hour on the program, the new Congress. 2 years ago, the word revolution got a workout. New members of the House were promised long hours and a killing pace until the items in the contract with America were considered. The 105th Congress begins with its members considering punishment for the Speaker of the House, a Senate with a firmed-up Republican majority, and new members and old talking about working together, getting things done. Maybe in 2 years we'll look back on this Congress as evolutionary. Once again, without term limits, many people left the House and Senate, making room for another large freshman class in both chambers. With an electorate saying it wants change, is it really possible for a newcomer to help set a new tone? Or do you almost automatically learn your way by sticking to the tried and true, following the path that so many others have walked before you? New faces on Capitol Hill this hour. Mike Enzi, who succeeded Alan Simpson in Wyoming, joins us from the Senate recording studio. Good to have you with us, Senator.
It's really good to be here.
Dick Durbin, who succeeded Paul Simon in Illinois, joins us from Decatur. Welcome back to the program, Senator.
Glad to be with you.
Susan Collins, who succeeded William Cohen in Maine, joins us from Maine Public Radio in Portland. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Senator.
Greetings from the great state of Maine.
And Mary Landrieu, who succeeded Bennett Johnston in Louisiana, joins us from the studios of the Louisiana State Network in Baton Rouge. Thanks for being with us, Senator.
Good afternoon, everyone.
If you'd like to join the conversation with four newly minted members of the United States Senate, they haven't been in office long enough to take on the Olympian airs of what sometimes calls itself the world's greatest deliberative body, still all very approachable. Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Well, any big surprises, Mike Enzi?
No, I've been very pleased by both the atmosphere and the attitude here in Washington. At the moment, it's a very cooperative and inclusive atmosphere between members of both parties, and there's a special camaraderie among those of us that are new here, I think.
Mary Landrieu, does that atmosphere that Senator Enzi just mentioned last only until the time that you finally do have your first big disagreement?
Well, I hope it lasts for a while because it's important for us to work together to, as someone said earlier, get the job done for the American people. There's so many important issues and challenges. I have been somewhat surprised coming from a state that's not quite as partisan as others. I know all the Democrats very well. I've gotten to spend a lot of time with Dick and all of our colleagues. I'm looking forward to getting to know some of the Republicans, Mike, on your side as we come up this week to really get started at work. So I think the more we get to know each other on a social level, and we'll be able to work that much better together in the political arena.
Well, it's not as much of a gee whiz as I think it arguably was in earlier Congresses to have large numbers of women around. And Susan Collins, Maine now has two women senators, both Republican.
Yes, Maine made history this fall by being the first state in the nation to elect two Republican senators. And we're very proud of that. I want to just add to something that Mary was saying. I think one of the pleasures of last week for me was when all of the women senators got together for a coffee to just talk about some of our common interests. Obviously, we span the ideological spectrum, but there are certain issues such as women's health issues and research issues where we are united, and I think that's going to be an interesting phenomenon in this Congress.
But Ray, I want to just add on that point with Susan. We had a wonderful time just visiting. One of my colleagues said, "And you all got together, Republicans and Democrats?" I said, "Yes." And we didn't throw anything. You know, we were fine. And we had coffee in Barbara Mikulski's office and Senator Mikulski. But about this women thing, I've been very surprised to know, and my constituents have really all clapped each time I've said that. I'm only the 25th woman to ever be elected to the United States Senate. I think, Susan, you're the 26th. And out of that, only 18 have been elected since the beginning of the country, out of about 1,840. So it's quite a small number. And to think that 9 of us are currently serving out of that 18 is really extraordinary. So we're happy to be here. We're there to represent everyone, but it is a step to try to diversify and broaden the representation in that body, which I know all the members support.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that it's really not going to drop much anymore, that you're probably on your permanent upward trend now.
Well, we hope so. It can't drop much further. You know, we hope it's an upward trend. It's hard to drop below, you know, the numbers. But I think, you know, as we all bring our life experiences to our work, that it's just really important to have a balance of representation. And so I'm really pleased, of course, to be there with Susan and the other women and all the guys. And we're just going to try to do the best we can for the people of the country.
You know, it's interesting in Maine because we're used to electing women. Obviously, Olympia Snow is in the Senate, but I remember when I was in high school meeting with Margaret Chase Smith. So we have a very proud tradition of electing women to high federal office in the state of Maine.
Well, Senator Durbin, the last time I saw you, you were still Representative Durbin. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what it's like to move across underneath the rotunda to the other side of the Capitol building and maybe contrast the different styles in the two places.
Well, it's a very positive experience from my perspective. The House of Representatives over the last 2 years has been very negative, very divisive, very combative. In fact, a lot of members, I think, chose to run for other offices and retire just because of the atmosphere and the environment. It had become entirely too personal. I had hoped, because I still have a warm spot in my heart for the House of Representatives, that this session would be better. It started out looking like it might be, but I'm afraid that the ethical controversies involving the Speaker and other members have really soured the environment. I'm heartened by the fact that the environment at our orientation was so positive and so bipartisan. I know from past experience that this honeymoon may end at some point, but I do believe that we have a very positive attitude going in, and a lot of us are hoping that with our new friends and new colleagues that we can work together on a bipartisan basis.
Well, Senator Enzi, tell us a little bit about what these first couple of weeks are like. Are you really meant to find your own way, or does the Senate provide people who say, okay, here's how we divvy up the offices, here's how we make arrangements for this and that and the other? How does that happen?
Well, as the person with the seniority number 100, I haven't had to worry about offices a lot. I get whatever is left over, and that's fine. We're operating out of quarters now that used to be a warehouse, and we have bunk bed desks. But it works well. Everybody's getting to know each other well. We've gotten all of our stuff unpacked. People are getting to introduce themselves around. I'm being introduced to legislation and new facilities, and it's a tremendous experience. It's a great learning curve, but it works well, and it comes together well, and there are a lot of people willing to help.
Well, I hope they took out the
the buckets and mops before you moved in rather than, you know, it's a little embarrassing.
Well, they had to take out the buckets and mops because there wouldn't have been room for us.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to four new members of the United States Senate today on Talk of the Nation. Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat of Louisiana, Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, Senator Mike Enzi, Republican of Wyoming, and Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine. Our number, once again, in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We'll go to the Bronx in New York. John, welcome to the program.
Hi. First, I'd like to say hi to the senator from Wyoming who had just taken Alan Simpson's place. And the only reason I'm singling him out is because a few days ago, Alan Simpson was on a talk show, and I was the last person to speak with him just before midnight, before he left his job as a senator. So ironically, I'm now speaking to his replacement. It's probably the first nationwide talk show he's done. I was curious about something. Knowing how extremely diverse America is, I know sometimes when you may not have had experience dealing with diverse cultures, especially considering how, polarization this type of society is, where people actually can be so diverse, we're seeming like we're in another world. I'm wondering, when you're trying to contemplate federal legislation that affects everyone, be it education or criminal justice, what have you, is there really you really feel secure within yourselves that you really can empathize with all different segments of this very complex and diverse society that we have?
Is that an invitation to all of them to come to the Bronx, John?
I don't think they want to, because they probably have so many stereotypes about us. But being human, I'm just wondering if they can possibly empathize with all the various segments of the society, because they're now being asked to pursue legislation and policy that's going to literally affect a quarter of a billion people who are so diverse that we might as well be living on different parts of this entire globe.
Well, why don't we go around the panel and hear from everybody on that. Senator Enzi?
I think that there probably isn't a true understanding of all of the diversity in all of the states, but each of us bring our own diversity from our own area of the state. And it's hope that all of the areas will learn from each of us and that we can mold something that will work for everyone. Of course, out in our area, we're real strong on states' rights, and we're hoping that the influence that I as a state senator can have is one that will allow those in Wyoming to make decisions for Wyoming that apply to Wyoming, rather than having some kind of a national consensus that tries to figure out what to do in Wyoming.
Senator Collins?
My response is very similar to John's question. I think it's really important that we give more power to local communities and to states to shape programs to meet the needs of their diverse populations. The Bronx could not be more different from Aroostook County in Maine, where I grew up. Each area of every state has different needs, and by empowering local communities and giving them the resources that they need from Washington and also leaving tax dollars in local communities, we can enable them to design programs that are going to meet the specific needs of their diverse populations. When we get in trouble is when Washington attempts to prescribe one program to meet the needs of everyone.
Dick Durbin, you come from a more rural area, but the politics of your state are dominated by an urban giant.
Well, I've learned a lot in the course of the campaign. I represented for 14 years a congressional district, rural, small town, white bread type of population, and then to be campaigning in the city of Chicago was like a trip to the United Nations. And the diversity of our state came home to me during the course of the campaign. But I don't think any of us should lose sight of the fact that the United States Senate is the great equalizer when it comes to diversity, that my colleagues here from the states of Wyoming and Maine and Louisiana have just as many U.S. senators as the state of New York or the state of Illinois. So that as there is diversity, we have said that in one chamber of this legislative process, there will be an equal voice, so that diversity can be represented with more equality.
Mary Landrieu, I only left you for last because I think you're the only city person in this crowd.
Yeah, from the wonderful city of New Orleans, and then represented, of course, the state as a state treasurer, and had similar experiences that Dick shared, coming out of an uptown district in New Orleans and then landing in some of these rural areas in the state, which is a real eye-opener. But we all learn to broaden ourselves and to think more broadly about issues so that we can do a better job individually. But getting back to the original question, I don't think any one of us can empathize with every group or share, obviously, every experience. But collectively, hopefully, the United States Senate, with its 100 members, brings collectively to the table a shared set of experiences that help us identify problems correctly and design and craft solutions that will work. So that is the great joy of working with a large group, a team, if you will. And again, we'll just continue to improve on that diversity in the years ahead.
John in the Bronx, thanks for your call. We'll move next to Charlotte, North Carolina. Rye is on a car phone.
Yeah, my question is similar to an earlier one about your adjustment to your new job. My question is about the committees which you're going to work on. Do you get to choose the committee? How does the committee function? And do you express your personal opinions or those of the people of your state?
Good questions, both of them. Well, Dick Durbin, as a minority member, how does the committee system work?
Not as well, no, quite honestly. let me just say...
Much better to be in the majority.
Most of us came in and asked for our favorite committee assignment. If it worked on the Republican side as it did on the Democratic side, those of us who are new are going to have to wait a while. We got good and important assignments, but not perhaps our first choice. How the committees work, I'm going to learn. I think the difference between the House and the Senate as well should be taken into consideration here. Under the rules of the Senate, the way it's constructed, each of us as U.S. senators has a greater voice in the debate. In the House, with 435 people involved, strict rules, limited access to debate, limited time to speak, and each member was really subordinated to the whole. In the Senate, I sense that there is more individual determination being made by each of the senators involved. In the last question that gentleman saved, I think was posed to either Plato or Aristotle as to whether legislators are to vote their conscience or to represent their constituents. And often, or I shouldn't say often, at least sometimes, there will be a conflict there. I have generally felt that you really have to be true to yourself. And if you are voting on a position that is not popular back home, you owe it to come home and very openly and candidly explain why you voted that way. And if the folks buy it and say, well, I see it differently, but I respect you for your point of view, they'll reelect you. If they don't care for you much, that's the end of it.
Susan Collins, the committee system on your side of the aisle?
The committee selections on the Republican side are done strictly according to seniority. I was fortunate among the five Republican freshmen who didn't have previous congressional experience. We did a drawing, and I got the first draw, so that was nice. We did a round-robin approach and to choose our committees and made our preferences known. It obviously is very difficult to get on committees such as Appropriations and Finance, but I was delighted with my committee assignments of labor and Human Resources, Governmental Affairs, and the Select Committee on Aging. I think it's as fair a system as could be worked out. It's everybody obviously would like to be on a lot of the same committees, so probably seniority is the best way to do it. As far as the second question, I feel fortunate that my political philosophy, I think, represents the mainstream voter in Maine, so I don't usually feel that kind of conflict. But in the end, I think the voters do want you to apply your own judgment, and that's what I try to do. I obviously will listen very closely to what my constituents tell me. But in the end, I don't think people want someone who is just holding a finger to the wind or consulting the polls, but rather they expect from their senator someone who will look carefully at the issue, study it, consult with their constituents and the experts on the issue, and then apply his or her best judgment, and that's what I'm going to do.
Well, Mike Enzi, that word seniority has come up a couple of times now. You, as number 100, did you end up on the Seaports Committee or something, representing Wyoming's naval interests?
Actually, I got the committees that I wanted.
Oh, terrific. And what are those?
I'm an accountant who's been in small business all my life. I've been selling shoes for a good deal of that life. And I campaigned on things that small business needed, and I was able to get on the Small Business Committee. I also was able to get on the Labor Committee and in the Wyoming Legislature. I've been in the House for 5 years and the Senate for 5 years, and I've served on the Labor Committee there. And it covers a number of the same issues that we have on the federal level, but ones that we haven't been able to make the kinds of decisions on the local level that we would have liked to because we were impeded by federal laws, and federal laws that at this point I don't understand the reasoning behind. So I'll get to work on that. I'm also on banking and on the Aging Committee. But I did get on committees that I have previous experience in and ones that I campaigned on and said that I'd like to solve some very specific problems. And for those, I shouldn't have any conflict. I think there was a great deal of affirmation on the particular issues that I campaigned on. So I'm anxious to go to work on those and achieve some things there.
And Mary Landrieu, the other part of Rye's question concerning representing your best judgment or the things that the people of Louisiana sent you there to do?
I think Susan said it beautifully about using your good judgment and common sense and using the experts that you find both in your state and in Washington to make determinations and then just do the very best you can. And of course, it's always a balance between voting your judgment and your conscience and representing your state. In my situation, I'm going to be on agriculture, on energy, and in small business, and clearly there's some strong positions on energy as an energy-producing state. The deregulation of the utility industry is going to be something we all have to tackle in this next year or two. And then I'm going to be looking forward, Mike, to working with you on the Small Business Committee, which I also asked for, because small business is the backbone of our economy. Here in Louisiana, we have very few Fortune 500 companies, and so the way that we can help and design to help facilitate the development of small business, the better off we all are. To try to create in this country more than minimum wage jobs, good, strong jobs for a solid future. So I'm excited, and I think Tom Daschle, I think, Dick, you would agree, did an excellent job on our side. We turned in our preferences, and then he, as the leader of the Democratic Caucus, tried to do his best to accommodate our request based on what we asked for and what is important to our states, and he did a beautiful job from what I can tell about how the caucus responded to those appointments.
Well, Ryan, Charlotte, you're the one who got us started down this road. What do you think of the answers you heard? And what do you want when you send your two senators to the U.S. Senate? Do you want them worrying about your ideas about the issues or really hearing all the evidence as they do in hearings, talking to all the people who come before them and then making their best judgment?
I think it should be a little bit of both. The senator is chosen based on a lot of different factors, but the people of the state, they elected him. He should take his opinions and listen to what everyone else has to say, and I guess, no, I'll change my mind. He has to go with what he thinks is right. He can't talk to every single person in the state that he comes from. If I could ask two more questions.
No, you can, unfortunately.
Okay.
There's a lot of other people who want to get in on this conversation, but Rye, thanks for calling us, and thanks for your good, thoughtful questions.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. If you're just joining us, Senator Mary Landrieu from Louisiana, Senator Susan Collins from Maine, Senator Mike Enzi from Wyoming, and Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, four new members of the United States Senate are with us this hour on the program. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we go next to St. Louis. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon to all of you. I'm so pleased and proud. I'm sitting here, a grandmother, feeling that these are my children who are acting in the way that I wish my children were in the position to act. We had 8 children, and they're all very productive people. Now we have 11 grandchildren, and this is a matter of my most concern. Basically, what I want to emphasize is, please, please, young people, keep your idealism, you particularly who are new to the legislative business, you who are not contaminated yet by the fall to roll and whatever happens there in Washington that causes people to accept without question immorality and moral ethics. Where have they gone? Our young people, our children are watching you. We oldsters are watching you. All of us are watching you guys. And we really hate to see condoned unethical practices as they have been I feel it demeans all of us. What has happened in the Republican Party, unfortunately, with Mr. Gingrich just lately, is just a travesty. Why do we continue to allow ourselves to be led down the road by people who have established their immorality? Why do we do it? Are we asking for more trouble? What happened to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire? You want to take it back that long? But anyway, my dear children, and I am talking to you like a 72-year-old grandma, hey, you've got the world on a string, and it's up to you to make it react like the yo-yo that you want it to, not in performing bad, but performing good. Nothing ever suffered from people who performed in the manner in which they know ethically, morally, that they are correct. And I expect that you will go over the year for it and do the same. You women, ladies, do you realize how fortunate you are? I wish I were half my age. Susan and Mary particularly, all of you I condone for making it to the big one. But Mary, Susan, go ye therefore and establish femininity where it should be, back in the place where we were respected and loved, and the position of a house homemaker, a housekeeper, the ladies who do the chores, Mary preparing the meal for the Last Supper perhaps, the ladies in the kitchen, these are the ones who are raising the children, who really need your support. Thank you so much for all of you, and thank you for allowing me to speak my word.
Elizabeth, thanks for your call. Well, not to lay on the pressure, but there it is, your assignment from St. Louis. Any thoughts?
I just would compliment her on her comments and to say to you, Elizabeth, I come from a family of 9 children. I'm the oldest of 9 and have a little boy, 4 and a half. And Frank and I are really excited about moving to Washington and being a part of this wonderful and exciting experiment in democracy and great country. And I just hope we can live up to all the ideals that you outlined. We'll sure try our best.
Could I add a point here, if I might?
Sure, Dick Durbin.
Having served in the House for a few years and having met a number of men and women who served in the House and the Senate, I can assure Elizabeth from St. Louis that most of them are very hardworking people, have good standards, really love their families, and are trying to do the best, even though we may see things a little differently from a political perspective. But I do hope that this session of Congress can address a very serious fundamental problem when it comes to campaign finance reform. All of us on the show today have just endured a Senate campaign and probably spent too many hours on the telephone begging for money so that we could get our message out. I have seen, I think, the worst conduct and the worst results in public service when a lot of money gets mixed into the process. I hope we can have real campaign finance reform that reduces the amount of money involved and lets good people legislate.
We're going to take a short break now. We're talking to 4 new members of the United States Senate this hour on Talk of the Nation. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation and take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. At 33 minutes past the hour, this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for Talk of the Nation comes from this and other NPR member stations and NPR. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Education Association, preparing America's students to meet the challenges of the 21st century, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Ray Suarez.
I imagine college is going to be this huge, wild orgy, but it's not at all.
In fact, more college freshmen are volunteering, working part-time, and considering helping professions than ever before, according to a new survey. We'll talk with some of the members of the class of 2000 about that survey and life on their campuses later on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. Today we're talking with four new senators from the 105th Congress about the issues and their agendas. My guests are Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming, and Senator Susan Collins of Maine. Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255. Greg's in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ray. I wanted to tell you that I'm from Wisconsin, not really from Minneapolis, and I remember when my freshman senator, Herb Cole, was running for re-election in Wisconsin as a freshman senator, a reporter asked him, what one legislative accomplishment can you point to which is evidence why Wisconsinites should vote for you again? And I remember he answered that he had prevented an increase in the gas tax, and I can't help thinking that perhaps that wasn't his what he was looking forward to 6 years prior. And so I guess I wanted to ask the senators today, when the reporter asks you 6 years from now what one legislative accomplishment you'd like to be able to point to so your constituents would reelect you, what do you think you'll say, or what do you hope to be able to say?
Okay, major goals for the coming term. Mike Enzi?
Well, I'd also like to thank Elizabeth, the grandmother of 11, for her comments. It ties in well with what we're talking about here, having strong families and having jobs, and I think that we do that through the balanced budget amendment. I campaigned hard on that in Wyoming. I think that it's essential that we get control of the budget of the United States. We are passing on an incredible debt to our kids and our grandkids, and we have an opportunity to reverse that and to go with a system where we have a matchup and hopefully even a balance so that we have the money to spend for the items that we need. So I would hope that we can get the balanced budget amendment and the necessary balanced budget and some payment on the deficit done during the time that I'm here, as well as reducing regulations for small business and making a flatter, fairer tax system. So those are some of the things that I'd like to see get done.
Susan Collins?
I want to help family businesses be passed on to the next generation without having to be sold to pay taxes. So one of my top priorities is to lower the very high federal inheritance tax that we have as it applies to closely held family businesses. As Mike and Mary mentioned earlier, small businesses, which are largely family-owned businesses, are responsible for most of the job growth in this country. In fact, in Maine, they're going to create more than two-thirds of the new jobs in the next decade. So if I had to pick one accomplishment that I hope to accomplish during my first term, it would be to provide some relief to our small businesses so that they can create more jobs. I also want to just thank Elizabeth, the grandmother, for her good wishes and to assure her that I will keep my idealism and my sense of public service.
Dick Durbin?
I'm worried about the disappearance of the middle class in America. And I think over the last 25 years, we've seen the wealthier folks in America grow in number and the poorer, unfortunately, grow in number as well. I think we've got to find ways to help those working families, many of whom have both husband and wife working, sometimes two jobs to try to make ends meet. It means a tax policy that helps them pay for college education, hospitalization insurance, and retirement. It means a focus on education. I wouldn't be sitting in front of this microphone coming from my family background without a chance given me by a school and a college student loan by a government. And I think it was a good investment. And I think we ought to make sure that we focus on those priorities in the next session of Congress.
Mary Landrieu?
I'd say a more effective partnership between the federal government and state and locals on the issue of education, trying to provide a real quality education for all of our children. There are no simple solutions to that challenge, but there are things that are working in this country to make every school work for every child and to have more parental involvement, more flexibility and accountability at the local level, and that is hands for, you know, covers Head Start for all children in the country, as well as putting a college education and technical education to make it affordable and accessible so that families can better their lot in life. And in investing in education and in our workforce, it will create great job opportunities to grow and strengthen the middle class of this country and grow our economy, which ultimately is what we want to do.
Greg in Minneapolis, thanks a lot for your call. New York City is back. Francis, welcome to the program.
Yes, I'd like to say that there are many issues, but I myself have one issue. And the word lobbyist is anathema to me. And I'll never forget my disappointment when they had that filibuster on the Lobby Reform Act. But then, later on, I felt better when I watched that debate in New Hampshire between the Speaker and the President. And they both came together and agreed when they get back to Washington, that Lobby Reform Act will take place. I would like to ask your guests, what input can they put in to see that that is taken care of?
Well, the famous photograph of the President and the Speaker of the House assuring that they would do what they could to bring along campaign finance reform. Then we had a national campaign since then, which, as Senator Durbin mentioned before the break, was anything but reformed. Who wants to start off?
Well, I'm a strong proponent of campaign finance reform. I proposed legislation during my own election that I look forward to introducing to put some voluntary spending caps on campaign spending and then provide incentives such as reduced broadcast time and reduced postal rates to people who comply. We do have a problem with the current system. There's too much money in it. I think that's the number one problem. We do spend an awful lot of our time when we're campaigning raising money rather than discussing issues.
But do you have the luxury of advocating that kind of approach that comes from coming from a small state with no major media markets?
Well, we have three media markets in Maine, and I spent over $1 million in my race, but I was grossly outspent in a primary by two very wealthy individuals. I was able to win despite that. But we have a real problem in this country if politics is going to be out of reach of people of average means like myself and reserved only for those who are personally wealthy. I think that's a major, major issue that we need to come to grips with.
Any comments?
Well, I would just agree with Susan and say also the question was also directed at lobbyist reform and lobby reform, and I believe the Congress took some steps in the last Congress to improve that situation, but I've always been one to argue that full and complete disclosure is a good way to prevent abuses. And part of the problem with our current campaign finance law, as well as lobbyist disclosure, is there's not full and accurate and immediate disclosure, which would prevent people from operating outside of what is, right and legal. So I hope that in both of those aspects, that more full disclosure can be one of the things that we push for.
Ray, I think America will be able to measure our sincerity on campaign finance reform by just watching for the next 90 days. If this is not the major issue that's taken into consideration by the House and the Senate so that it applies to the 98 election, you can bet little or nothing is going to occur. We really have to put ourselves on a timetable. I would agree with Susan in her comments about voluntary limitations. We still have to worry about some Supreme Court decisions. But let's get real honest about this. If we're going to clean up a system that just generated an election turnout the lowest in 72 years for a presidential race, we've got to restore confidence and integrity in the system, and it means campaign finance reform.
Dick Durbin, how much did your last race cost you?
About $2 million in the primary, and I'm guessing around $5 million in the general, and I spent less than Paul Simon did to be reelected 8 years or 6 years before. So he had spent $8 million. So it is extraordinarily expensive for someone who is not a millionaire.
Well, Mike Enzi,
does this really apply to you that much? I mean, how many people are in Wyoming? About 600,000?
About 460,000.
Oh, I overstated then. Go ahead.
But we campaign out there, too.
Sure.
And, we're able to do more of a door-to-door campaign, and that's what people expect out there. But the media markets, even from the surrounding states, affect us quite a bit. And to the list that's already been mentioned, I would like to also add truth in advertising so that ads that do not have the truth in them can be taken off of the air. And I think that there ought to be the approval of the candidate on every ad that's run for him, regardless of who runs it. Some of the indirect expenditures prohibit the candidate from having any input, and there's a lot of confusion generated by ads that are not entirely correct, and I'd like to see some changes in that. There was mention of the lobbyists in Washington, And one of the things that we've done during our orientation here was get some information on the ethics that are imposed by the Senate on the senators. And it seems to be a very complete ethics bill and pretty much limits any expenditures on behalf of anybody in order to get any influence. So I think that they have corrected the system, and in fact some of the people feel that it's been overcorrected. But people from the state that a person is from absolutely will have more access to their senators than will the lobbyists, and I think that's one of the things that Francis was getting at.
Have you, in your short time in the Senate, already had some visits?
Actually, I've been visited by 1/1,000th of the people from Wyoming already.
Actually, been here,
but there aren't many that to have to do that. And I've been pleased with the letters, telephone calls, and personal visits that I've had from people from Wyoming. And, of course, we're giving great access.
But, Ray, could I quickly add to the caller and others that may be listening that proper lobbying and correct lobbying is essential to our system of government. We receive telephone calls from individual, voters, representatives of nonprofit organizations, representatives of churches and synagogues and other community organizations, as well as those representing corporations and a variety of interests, and that provide good and solid information to us personally, to our staffs. They are an integral part of this whole system of debate and understanding about these issues. So when lobbying is done in the right way, under guidelines and as outlined, it is essential to good government and to effective government. It's when it's abused that we have to watch and always be careful for when a few or a small group have too much access or too much influence, and others are excluded from the process because laws are not followed or it's not a level playing field. So that's our job, to keep the laws straight. But lobbying, if done in the right way, is essential to the kind of government we have.
Well, Senator Landrieu, right. I think that's a great point, because too often people say lobbying with a certain tone of voice, basically, it's not lobbying if it's something that you agree with. That's education or legislative education. And if it's something you don't agree with, it's those scummy lobbyists. And we really do have to be clear that that lobbyists do have a function, especially when so many bills are passing your desks. You can't possibly become an expert on the thousands of issues that you're asked to speak for your state on. Susan Collins, you were going to say?
Yes, I just wanted to add one more thought on the campaign finance issue, which is related in some ways to the lobbying issue as well. And it was Mike Enzi's comment that triggered it. In addition to the inequity created by the difference in personal wealth and access to the system, I think we have a serious issue that Congress needs to grapple with outside special interest groups being able to come into a state like Maine, where the media is considered relatively cheap compared to a large state, and trying to influence an election in the final days. We saw this happen in Maine. It happened in my race. It happened in a House race, where outside powerful special interest groups poured in hundreds of thousands of dollars in an attempt to sway the race. And that's a real issue. The whole so-called independent expenditure, which due to the Supreme Court decision now appears to have no spending limits at all, raises a real threat to the ability of people, particularly in small states like Maine, to control the outcome of their races.
But how do you put in limits and caps without running afoul of the freedoms that we seem to be guaranteed by the Constitution to say what we want and spend money in order to broadcast our voices to do it?
Ray, if I could comment on that.
Sure.
I think the Supreme Court says that a person can use his wallet or her pocketbook to finance their freedom of speech. But for goodness sake, shouldn't we have disclosure about where that money's coming from? In the closing days of my campaign, I sat down one night trying to go to sleep the Saturday before the election, turned on the TV, there was my mistake, and saw three straight ads against me, none of them sponsored by the Republican Party or my opponent, all by different committees and groups I'd never heard of. And if you believe that the Citizens for Term Limits collects their money in kettle drums at shopping centers and on street corners, you're wrong. These are special interest groups. They've glommed onto a specific issue. They should make full disclosure. Let's find out who they really are.
who's putting the money up in the name of a certain issue. I think that's at least a step in the right direction.
Four new members of the United States Senate are with me this hour. You just heard Dick Durbin of Illinois, Mike Enzi of Wyoming, Susan Collins of Maine, and Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Indianapolis, Indiana's next. Mike, welcome to the program.
Ray, a pleasant good day to you.
Thank you.
And congratulations to all the senators. I can't hear you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
They're grateful for your good wishes.
The only one question I have to ask is, what is your view on the line item veto? Hello?
Hello? Anybody? Yeah,
they're thinking about
this
it.
Is Mike Enzi.
Go ahead, Mike.
Enzi, and I've been operating in Wyoming under a line item veto for a number of years, and I think it's a tremendous tool for reducing budgets. We've had some frustration by governors who were trying to use it, and their frustration was that there's no way to put additional money into a budget using a line item veto. I think there are some pretty good safeguards set up on the federal process for the line item veto, and if it isn't abused with threats, I think that it will be a great tool for helping to keep things in line and eliminating pork from the budget and allowing us to get on with the business with a balanced budget.
I agree with Mike. It gives a lot of power, though, to the executive and with it responsibility to keep the budget in line. We've operated in Louisiana with a line item veto now for many, many years, and it's worked with both Republican and Democratic governors. And although I know it's a major change for Washington, if done correctly and responsibly, can help to keep our financial house in Washington in order. I mean, democracies are threatened from collapse, not usually from outside military intervention or invasion. It's from internal collapse of monetary policy, loose fiscal policy. So I think the great challenge of this country is to try to get our fiscal house in order, balance our budget, keep things in order so we do have the money to invest in the things we know will move our country forward: education, infrastructure investment, technology, and research that will make our country continue to be the strongest nation on earth, both economically and militarily.
I support the line item veto because I view it as a useful tool to curtail wasteful spending, particularly those pork barrel projects that are sneaked into large appropriations bills that can't possibly, the bills themselves can't possibly be vetoed. I am somewhat concerned about how it's going to be used, and it will be up to the president to use it responsibly and to not use it, that power as a bargaining chip to get votes on the administration's initiatives. So assuming that it's used properly, it can be a very useful tool for deleting wasteful spending.
Well, I voted for it as a member of the House, and if I'm not mistaken, I think it's a four-year experiment where we're going to see if it works. It'll save us from some of the embarrassments like $500,000 for Lawrence Welk's home and those sorts of things. But I think we ought to keep it in perspective. In the worst years of our federal deficits, Congress did not appropriate as much money as the president asked for. It just appropriated it for different things. So the idea of giving the president the power to cut money is not necessarily a guarantee that the right things are going to be invested in. But I think it's worth a try. Let's see what it does.
Well, we only have just about 2.5 minutes left, and I won't be able to hear from all four of you on this. But during the past hour, we've been talking about compromise, about getting along, about a new spirit in both chambers. And I'm wondering how you move away from the recent talk of compromise as a form of surrender. All four of you have come believing strongly in certain things and wanting to get specific things done and wanting to win certain battles. Is compromise sort of the necessary oil that keeps this place lubricated and moving forward? And is there a way that you can define compromise away from surrender?
Margaret Chase Smith, the senator, former senator from Maine, the legendary senator, once said that there's a difference between the compromise of principle and the principle of compromise. And that's what guides me. I think that the American people are tired of divisive finger-pointing, that they don't like the bickering and the political games, and they do want us to work together. Compromise is not a dirty word in my book. I think trying to achieve consensus on difficult issues is the way to go, and that's the approach that I'm going to take.
Well, we heard from a Republican on that one. Now, what about our two Democrats?
Go ahead, Dick.
Well, it's part of the process, and if you don't accept it as a premise, I think you don't understand that men and women come to this process with good intentions and good faith and do see things differently, and we do have to find a moderate approach, a compromise many times to make sure that there is progress. One of the worst things that occurred 2 years ago was when one of the leaders said, "I will never compromise." I just knew we were in for it. And we ended up with government shutdowns and a lot of division that I think people rejected in the last election.
Well, you've been both in the majority and the minority. Does compromise look different from those two positions?
It looks a lot better when you're in a minority. You really favor it more. But I think in all honesty, if you're going to be fair in this process, that you have to encourage compromise and try to be inclusive. And I hope in the Senate, the way it's split 55-45, that we can have more and more bipartisan measures.
Mike Enzi, we only have half a minute left. Go ahead.
I would hope that we would look at the things for what's right for our country. I think it's a pretty simple premise that we do what's right, we do our best, and we treat others as we want to be treated. And we're a part of the world's most successful, oldest deliberative body. And I think that that's the principle that we have to operate on, looking to the good of the country. And I do think it's possible to compromise and work together and come up with the best solutions.
Mike Enzi, thanks for being with us today on the program.
Thank you.
Mary Landrieu, a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Dick Durbin, good to talk to you again.
Glad to join you from Decatur.
And Susan Collins, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And good luck to all four new members of the United States Senate. Thanks to all who called. Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat from Louisiana, joined us from Louisiana State Network in Baton Rouge. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois. Senator Durbin joined us from WSOY in Decatur. Senator Mike Enzi, Republican from Wyoming, joined us from the Senate recording studio here in Washington. And Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, joined us from Maine Public Broadcasting in Portland. Tune in to Talk of the Nation at this time tomorrow for a discussion about negotiating peace in the Middle East. In Washington, I'm Ray Suarez, NPR News.
NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts of Talk of the Nation are available. Call anytime, toll-free, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. That's 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for Talk of the Nation comes from NPR member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Pew Charitable Trusts for in-depth coverage of the environment, arts, and religion, and the William T. Grant Foundation supporting research on the development of children, adolescents, and youth. This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. This is NPR, National Public Radio.